On the programme celebrating the work of the mother of modernism, Eileen Gray at IMA. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight and this second programme to mark the reopening of the main buildings at the Irish Museum of Modern Art at Kilmainham in Dublin. Tonight we look at their main exhibition, Eileen Gray, Architect, Designer, Painter, an exhibition seen earlier this year at the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the city where Gray made her home for most of her adult life. Eileen Gray is now acknowledged as one of the major figures in modernist art in the 20th century, a unique and brilliant talent whose achievement was too long overshadowed by the rather more self-proclaiming voices of people like her contemporary and sometimes friend Le Corbusier. Gray was born in County Wexford in 1878, studied in Paris and at the Slade School of Art in London, and went on to forge a singular career as a designer, a maker, an architect and artist. Her furniture, lamps and carpets are remarkable for their individuality, their clean aesthetic and their blending of Art Deco and timeless. And the few houses she designed as a self-taught architect are now seen as masterpieces of innovation. Since her death in 1976, the significance of Eileen Gray's achievement has become apparent. A feature film and a documentary about Gray are due to be released next year. In Ireland, we're fortunate that a significant collection of her work and papers have been given to the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks in Dublin. Some items from this are included in the Eileen Gray exhibition at IMA. And we begin tonight's programme with a visit to that exhibition in the company of Jennifer Goff from the National Museum. Jennifer Goff of the National Museum. We're here at the Eileen Gray exhibition at IMA, Eileen Gray architect, designer, painter. And I suppose this exhibition really illustrates her power in these three areas. And some of the material gifted to the National Museum is an intrinsic part of this exhibition too.
It is, and it's lovely to see material which has been in the archives for the last 10 years actually out here on display. And it was important from the very onset with the exhibition in IMA. They were very gracious that we worked very, very closely with Chloe Pitiot, the curator of this exhibition from the Pompidou, as well as when the show was in Paris. So there were 64 pieces that came over from the museum.
Let's go on and I want to look at the table that you found in the museum. But you saw this exhibition earlier in the year in the Pompidou Centre in Paris.
Yes. Initially, Chloe had come to me about probably 2 years ago and had said that they were doing this large exhibition in Paris and had wanted to borrow pieces from the National Museum. So we just opened up the doors and said, look, pick and choose, take a selection, and you know, we'll work very much accordingly. And the show in Paris was a very bold, dramatic statement. I mean, this actual exhibition, not that I want to sit down and compare, I like this one because it's much more intimate, and it's also, it firmly grounds her back to her Irish roots, and that's one of the key things that they have tried to do here at IMA, and it's so important that we embrace literally the mother of modernism, and she was Irish.
And you would argue that, in fact, she had a very strong sense of an Irish identity.
Oh, absolutely. I was initially, when I first started 12 years ago, working and researching on Gray, I would have been of the original belief she was Anglo-Irish, she was an expat, she left and she never came back. It's not true. We do know that she came back to Ireland right up until 1954. She was devastated when the family home was sold to the Wexford Health Board, and it was changed into a tuberculosis hospital. And she was very upset with her sister Ethel when Ethel sold the house in 1929. And there's these incredible descriptions of her childhood in Ireland. And one of the things that I love is that she had said, you know, she remembers boating on the River Slaney. She used to come to the horse show with her mother. They used to love to go up and see the hunters. And her father used to go off and paint in Italy and Switzerland, and she used to say she couldn't understand why her father went and painted in these parched climates when he could be painting cool green slimy things in Wexford.
That's a great, great image. Jennifer, here, the table that came to light in among the material in the National Museum.
In the archives, it came in as part of the body of work in the second archive that we had acquired from Peter. And in amongst all of this boxes of material were tabletops, or cutouts for tabletops. Like, you see different examples of tables in the exhibition, the little adjustable tables or the occasional tables. And there was literally just this very crude, basic, painted blue tabletop, and then underneath is her handwriting, written furtively everywhere, giving descriptions that there's supposed to be a drawer, the measurements, how it's supposed to work, and how it's supposed to be attached into a wall. And in one of the boxes, I found the pronged nickel-chromed legs, and then realised that there were three holes in the table and ended up assembling it together. And ironically, when Peter Adam came over to the show, he stood here and looked at this table and said, "Where did this come from?" I said, "Peter, this was the collection that came from you." And he said, "Was that that tabletop and those legs?" He goes, "Oh my God, they went together." And I said, "Yes."
So you restored an original piece of
Literally,
Line and Grace.
And it was just, it was, again, you can see it's a very, very crude piece. It was one of the pieces that she was playing with. And I suspect we're hopefully going to be able to do paint samples, maybe, because the colour blue very much echoes the same colours that were used in the house of E1027. And that curved form that you can see, and it's slightly just 10 degrees at an angle at the side. And I think she was playing, this again would have been a maquette or a model for a table that would have been incorporated into the architecture of E1027. Many pieces in the house would have been, you know, attached or fixed into a wall. It didn't quite work. And as a result now, I believe this table was probably absolutely used at her last house, Lou Peru, because you can see it's been quite utilised.
Mentioning the house, her E1027, we might go and have a look at the model for that, because there are some beautiful models in this exhibition as well, which give us a really strong sense of her design.
And they were from the Irish Architectural Archive, so it's wonderful that they got these models in as well, so that was a great idea.
Jennifer, I love the way, as well, as you walk here, you get a flash of something else in another room. So this blue wall and this wonderful cabinet flashing out at us, you know, the mirror and these drawers. And it's a really, really striking piece.
This piece has actually come from the Pompidou Centre, and it was the original bathroom cabinet that came from the principal bedroom of E1027. And when it's closed, it is plain aluminium, it's quite cold, it's quite harsh, very much that idea of modernist materials. But then when you open it up, you see the cork drawers, and some of the cork drawers are actually lined with silver. And the idea of the cork drawers were that if somebody was asleep in the bed and somebody was in the bathroom with their toiletries, that the cork muffled the sound. And I just, again, it's this whole idea that she just looked at every aspect of how we live.
You think of everything. Again, when you open this, there's a mirror.
There's
inside
mirror.
The door.
And the mirror worked in tandem with the satellite mirror, which was a round circular mirror. It's you can now buy reproductions. And there was a central kind of an oracle that came out from this mirror. And it was basically, she designed the two of them to work together, because Badovici had a bit of a thing about his hair, and that his hair was cut straight at the back. And she said that these were designed for l'homme qui aime bien regarder sa nuque, the man that likes to look at the back of his neck.
This extraordinary model for her house, E1027, in the south of France, I think it gives a very, I've never been there, but it gives one a really, really strong sense of both the house and the landscape around it.
She chose for her first architectural project an exceedingly difficult site. She'd only had done a model for a house for an engineer beforehand, and then between 1926 and 29, this house was constructed for the client, Jean Badovici. But she gave him co-authorship with the name E1027, E for Eileen, 10 for Jean, J, the 10th letter of the alphabet, 2 for the second letter of the alphabet, which was Badovici, B for Badovici, and 7 for G for the 7th letter of the alphabet, which was G for Grey. So she was quite... absolutely. But the house itself, it was quite an extraordinary sight. It was quite a challenge, but I think overall she completely achieved what she was looking to do. And it's actually quite a small house, but that gives the impression, even on the inside, that it is actually quite spacious, and it's her whole approach that she took to it. And literally, she has actually slightly twisted the house to a 10-degree slant on the elevation, so it maximises to the whole aspect of the house is what many people called the choreographic approach to architecture. And she literally looks at the way that air ventilation went through the house, the way that the light moved through the house. And if you look at the house, even from the sea, even if it is here in the model, it looks like a boat. And there are many references to nautical architecture.
Something I'd love to have a look at, and I suppose it's one of the things that brought her back into focus, is some of the lacquer work.
Absolutely.
In the furniture. We might just have a look at some of that. This screen, again, from around the mid-20s. Remarkable piece of work.
This six-panelled lacquer screen would have been one of the larger lacquer projects that she had done. And for many people, you don't realise the amount of time and effort it took to do pieces such as this. Lacquer isn't like it is today, like a spray-painted lacquer. It's a very long technical process, but to give a brief description, you prime your wood. You then cover your wood with a very thin layer of silk gauze that's applied with a rice gum. Then you get your lacquer, which is a sap that comes from the roos tree, and that takes over a week just to collect the sap. The sap is also highly poisonous, so Grey had a really awful skin disease in her hands in her early years because she never wore protective glove wear, and she had a terrible shake in her hands towards the end of her life. And then your natural lacquer, which you see here, this lovely chocolate colour from this incredible six-panelled screen. This literally you would have painted on each layer of lacquer. You had to do it in a very humid environment. So initially she worked out of her bathroom. Each layer of lacquer took 10 days to dry, and these individual pieces would have up to 30 or 40 layers of lacquer. So if you think of the output of pieces, lacquer pieces that she did, it really was quite extraordinary.
Jennifer, because furniture again, so central to the Eileen Gray eye, and people talk about a particular Eileen Gray chair. Here's a chair that has become iconic. I mean, this couldn't be anybody else.
No, it couldn't. This is designed, it's called the Transat chair, inspired by the deck chairs that she had experienced on ocean liners. She had travelled to the States in 1910, and this chair evolved into a series of chairs. So what's great here with the exhibition, you actually see two different types of Transat chair, and it's how she again completely adapted a piece to the owner's needs. So this particular chair was done for Jean Badovici. He had long legs, and you can see the chair has actually been extended. And also the upholstered headrest, which swivels at the back. It's just done in plain sycamore, but this upholstered headrest has four pads because Badovici wanted extra support. Whereas the other transat chair that you see, that's in lacquer, it's also a very transitory piece between her lacquer work to her more simple furniture, was done for the Maharaj of Indore, who was a much more slight man. So it's slightly narrower and it's slightly thinner, and it only has three upholstered cushions on the back of the headrest. So it's just, again, how she really observed how people used objects, and especially with the transat chair, when it was created around the time for E1027, she became completely engrossed in the way that people ate, how they slept, how they used an object, how they even digested food. And I think even with another chair, the dining chair, she slightly altered the legs on the chair to help digestion. So it's this is how it's so incredible. But with the transat chair, what's lovely is that you see the next evolution in this exhibition, and it's the S-Bend chair. And that particular chair she had done for her house on Papaya. And at that stage, she wanted furniture to fold in on itself and to be easily stored. So the S-Bend chair was an evolution of the transat chair. And then by the last years of her life, she actually did design a deck chair, a plain, simple deck chair. So it's lovely again to see how her evolution of thought has come from, you know, the 20s through to the 30s, then through to the 50s and 60s.
And all the way through, again, the very beautiful object.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, everything being aesthetically pleasing, but she probably would kill people if you said something was beautiful. But she also would kill you if you said functional, because it wasn't. Things weren't supposed to be functional. They were supposed to be user-friendly, but which is functional?
Caroline Constant, Professor of Architecture at the University of Michigan. The exhibition here at IMA, the Eileen Gray exhibition, architect, designer, painter. Of those three strands, how significant an architect was Eileen Gray?
That's a hard question to answer. I think considering that she only built a few things, she was extremely significant. And I think it's interesting how many people she's influenced, particularly the people who've been here at this exhibition and the symposium the last few days, that it's clear that she's finally really being recognized in Ireland and having a broad influence. And I think that's what's important. How significant she was in her time is a little harder to say.
The three buildings, taking, and I haven't yet visited her famous house in the south of France, but from images, from photographs, it does seem like this remarkable work that seems to almost inhabit the space around it quite perfectly, and in a unique way that echoes so much of the rest of her work. Because in a sense, looking at everything she did, there's this really strong sense of the architectural from everything.
Well, I think that that's true of all the houses that she built. I mean, even the last one, Le Perru, which is very modest, is so wedded to its site. And Castellar, the one that she lived in after E1027, is equally incredibly wedded to its site. And those two later houses that she did for herself were both built on ruins. And so they sort of incorporated the ruins as part of the body of the work. At Castellar, in fact, there's a public footpath going sort of between the building and part of its property. So there's a little bridge she has to get over to the other part of the property. And they're all really remarkable. And they all have bedrooms facing east to wake you up in the morning. And they all have living rooms facing south to watch the setting sun. And so I think the fact that she could find these three very disparate sites and the architecture is quite different, but the approach is quite similar.
I think in looking at Gray, you would point to her designs challenging some theoretical assumptions of modern architecture. Talking about her ability to reinstate the bodily experience of space as this primary function. Tell me a little bit about that, how you believe she did that.
Well, that's pretty complicated, but I think that she was always working sort of in dialogue with the kind of currents around her, currents in the decorative arts, currents in architecture, I think that there's what's really original about her, and because when I was in school, she was considered derivative, which I never believed. And I think what's really original about her is the way she takes some of the precepts of De Stael architecture or the architecture of Le Corbusier, sort of operates in dialogue with it and critiquing it, and in so doing, making the bodily experience of space a really major component. So that everything she does, the way you touch the furniture, the way it's sort of tactile, the way the handles on things sort of vary according to how you would open a drawer or whatever, all of those things are really incredible. And then the sensuality of the bathrooms and the dressing areas is, you know, really evident in the photographs.
What made you alert to the fact that she wasn't really derivative? I mean, what what drew you to that feeling?
Well, it took me a long time. because when I was in school, I was in graduate school at Princeton in the 70s, and there was a tiny exhibition of her work that went around the country, and it showed at my school. And I was just floored. I just thought, here's a hero. It's not necessarily because she was a woman, but I couldn't figure out how to talk about it or why it was so influential to me. And it took me about 25 years. And it actually took a lot of reading about sort of feminist discourse in relationship to architecture and stuff. And so even though I think, I mean, she was a feminist before her time in a way, in architectural terms. Obviously, in political terms, she was a feminist too. But and so that kind of discourse that was happening in the 80s and 90s helped me understand what I thought was so special about her work. And then I spent 12 years obsessing and trying to. I mean, the archives at that time were so disorganized, and getting any information was often just a kind of whim.
You're a member, an honorary member of the Royal Yes. Institute of Architects of Ireland, and of course Eileen Gray was also a member. That must be kind of Nice.
Oh, that was the most thrilling thing I think that ever happened to me, and that I was able to get it because of donating the models that my students had made. And I think it was the biggest honor I've ever had, and that I didn't have to wait to be 95 to get it.
Caroline Constant, thanks so much. Jennifer, the quote here, and it's again, time and again, you're reminded of how perceptive Eileen Gray was in her writing. You know, painting is evident or destructive. And she has these really pithy observations all the way through. But we're in this room of her paintings, and again, you see amazing diversity in it.
Completely. From her early art school drawings to... which we now know she destroyed most of her early artwork as a student. She studied initially at the Slade and then the Ecole Colorisée and the Académie Julien. And I know she was very, very good at anatomy drawing because there's one actual drawing. And seemingly at the Ecole Colorisée they used cadavers that were rescued from the Seine. There's quite an incredible description from a very good friend of Gray's who was describing their days studying at the Ecole Colorisée, and the positions that they seemingly placed the cadavers was quite astonishing. But she also, it was one of the reasons why she was allowed to remain in France with her family, was because she had a painting received at the Salon, and Chloe discovered it was, the title of the painting was Les Derniers Rayons d'une Belle Journée, The Last Rays of Sun on a Beautiful Day. And many people think that the minute she began to do the lacquer work, that she stopped painting, and that's not true. She continued to paint all throughout her life. In her latter years, she was doing a number of paintings that you see here, sometimes in conjunction with her niece, Prunella Clough, who was a very, very well-known abstract expressionist in England at the time. And she was exceedingly interested in form, light, shade, and kind of almost extensions or distortions of objects.
And of course, this exhibition continues until late January, but after that, people can still see a considerable amount of Eileen Gray's work in the National Museum at Collins Barracks.
We have a permanent exhibition. When the first collection was acquired, we wanted to make sure that there was a permanent display up in Collins Barracks. So that opened in 2002. And it will not be removed. So it kind of tells every aspect of her life from her lacquer days through to the end of her years. And again, with the permanent collection, we wanted to firmly show that she wanted to come home. And she longed for Ireland, it was what she said. And in this letter that we found in the archives in the National Museum, she said that she'd hoped that she would have something in Ireland, but she supposed it was too late now. And I think with this exhibition at Emma and then with the permanent exhibition in Collins Barracks, we've brought her home.
Jennifer Goff of the National Museum of Ireland there at Emma. And this is the voice of Eileen Gray herself.
I was very interested because I'd always wanted to learn lacquer. And so I said, I suppose I could never come here and work. And they said, but you can. Start on Monday if you like.
Also at Emma, I meet artist Sarah Brown, who acknowledges her admiration for Eileen Gray. Sarah Brown, I suppose you've paid homage to Eileen Gray several times in your artwork, and we're here at One Foot in the Real World, the exhibition of work from the permanent collection. And here, again, you are paying tribute to Gray in text and image around on panels around three of the walls here.
Yes, there's a couple of works that are related. So there's a piece from 2010 called From Margin to Margin, Looking for Eileen. And I suppose my engagement with Eileen Gray happened by accident, really, that it was initially through the Venice Biennale and working with a particular company and dealing with ideas of national representation and feminine labour, that there was this Eileen Gray coincidence. And following that, I was commissioned by the Daimler Collection to make this research piece about Eileen Gray. So that's the book that you see on the walls. And the book is actually, it's a series of correspondences between me and Eileen, who doesn't answer back, and also various other people that I attempted to involve in some way to find out what a kind of appropriate response might be to her work. So during the course of that, I actually found out that I actually really wanted to do something that didn't look like her work. I'm not particularly interested in making some kind of pastiche. And what emerged through the course of the research, when I wanted to use the materials budget to have her grave remarked, was actually that her ashes had been moved from Père Lachaise to a suburban cemetery in Paris and scattered in an area for bodies donated to science. So it became really a kind of impossible task to make anything material in relation to this person who seemed to want to disappear. So the sale of the book actually generated this fund to make some other work in the service of the memory of Eileen Gray was really the contract that I set myself.
And Sarah, the colour here, the green, I think has a particular reference to Eileen Gray as well.
The green is the colour of the maid's bedroom in E1027, this house in the south of France that Eileen made. And it was something that came about through the research I was doing, that there were these colours in the work that had been invisible previously.
The book then, as you say, culminates in this poem by Alice Lyons, a kind of, as she does so well, this visual poem, and it's a lovely, lovely piece.
I approached Alice to see if she was interested in making some kind of poetic response, particularly with the idea that it would be translated into Morse, kind of thinking about the relationships of radio and Morse, both to, I suppose, that World War II era and E1027 again, but also modernist experiments in poetry and telegraphic poetry, and thinking about something that would be continually disseminated into the ether for Eileen. So Alice has made this really beautiful poem called Something Permanent, and the look of the poem refers to a carpet by Eileen Gray called Centimetre, the Centimetre rug. So it has a particular visual appearance, and it also incorporates some of Eileen's own writing from her notebook.
Having fallen into oblivion like the skin of a little silver fish, I should have liked so much the whites of her eyes, but I suppose she inscribed a single word, something permanent lit from inside. What's the Morse that goes out then? What is that? What's it saying?
The Morse is a translation of the poem. And the more there's a series of correspondences and translations in the work that are quite complex and that are open to the idea that I lose control and that other people become involved in something that's discursive rather than fixed. So I collaborated with members of the Southeastern Amateur Radio Group, based in Waterford mainly, and they have applied for a license on my behalf for the project. So that's called EI2EEN. So it looks like Eileen, and this is the temporary call sign of the radio station. So it starts with the transmission of the call sign and CQ, seeking you. And then when somebody answers, the poem can begin. So in a way, it is a little bit like the call and response of the letters, just sonically, really, and much further away. So there's quite a condensed, modest manifestation of the work in the gallery. It's just a desk and a radio and some text. But then this aerial that extends out of the space starts to maybe gesture towards a much larger audience that isn't physically present.
With the world and time. So the, yeah. Poem in Morse for Eileen Gray. Sarah, you also have work in an exhibition of photographs called Still We Work, which has been on at the Gallery of Photography in Dublin and will be seen in Galway. Tell me a little bit about that.
So Still We Work is a really exciting project that is the culmination of a year's work. And there's four artists involved, myself, Anne Talentire, Vagabond Reviews, and Miriam O'Connor. And it's curated by Valerie Connor and commissioned by the National Women's Council. So the subtitle of the work is, of the project is Representations of Women and Work. So it departs from the photographic representation of women. But then the work in the exhibition is actually quite mixed. There's photographs, there's drawings, there's also more textual research projects that all try to address in different ways, I suppose, again, some of the invisible qualities of how women are represented today, how they work, and to revalue some of those understandings.
Artist Sarah Brown there. music from the opening movement of Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov, a nod to Eileen Gray's admiration for and influence from the designs for the Ballet Russe. And to celebrate Gray's work and legacy, the Royal Irish Academy of Music, Chamber Ensemble and Friends will perform a series of concerts at IMA, the first on Sunday next, November the 17th, then December the 1st and January the 19th. Full details on nch.ie. Mary McCucken, tell me about the film The Price of Desire that you're making about Eileen Gray.
Well, it's a film set not so much about the life of Eileen Gray, but more because it was such a long life with so many careers. So it focuses mostly on the story around the house that Eileen Gray built, E1027 in Roquebrune, Cap-Martin.
And that house, of course, so central to a significant part of her life and very, very much to her art.
Very much so. I mean, a lot of people would say it, or certainly I would agree and contend that it is kind of the apotheosis of a life's work. It is invested with all of the excellence and energy and emotion and aesthetic that a lifetime's work had brought her to a place of kind of such a level of experience and inventiveness that this house. She invested everything in the interior, exterior, and layout, and all aspects of the house. Because I'm no architectural expert, but it's a very, very beautiful place and an extraordinary piece of work.
What drew you to this story? What drew you to want to make it for film?
Well, inevitably, we're always a huge fan of Eileen Gray, but for film, the question that you always have to ask is, well, where is the film in this, and what qualifies it to be a film story? So I had to spend a little bit of time just ruminating with it and thinking, well, what is it about Eileen Gray's life that has something universal to say? And in that story around the house and the relationships between herself and Jean Badavici, her lover, who was also Le Corbusier's promoter, emerged a story that seemed to have something to say about the condition of the female artist. And so inevitably that becomes the universal or the underlying theme or thesis of the film, this insidious chauvinism, a lifetime of little kind of knocks that I suppose what the film tries to do is answer the question, what was it really? We all know that she was not recognized to the extent she should have been and lost her moral right and her property rights to the house as both architect and owner of the house. And we all ask the question, why is it or what was it about Eileen Gray or her life or her time that caused that to happen? And so it's on an emotional level, the film tries to explore that from the female perspective.
Orla Brady playing the part of Eileen Gray. Who's playing Corbusier?
I'm just kind of thrilled that the film is very, very authentically cast, and it was really a joy and took some effort, and it was wonderful that Orla was in the end able to play Eileen Gray because she is authentically an Irish French-speaking actress who just is perfect. And likewise with Le Corbusier, Vincent Perez, who was a great star in France but is Swiss originally, was born in Chaux-le-Fonds, is a painter, is a Renaissance artist, so he spent a year preparing and has really done an extraordinary job trying to find the Le Corbusier that an audience would respond to despite his behaviour.
And of course a great actor he is, so he should be able to do that. Mm-hmm. A fascinating story as well around how the film, in a sense, brought life back to that house. I mean, making the film there has been key to really important restoration work on the house.
Well, I hope so. I mean, we can't pretend to be responsible for the restoration of the house at all, but certainly the timing of production along with the quite complex efforts involved around the restoration of the house and much discussed and much argued in the press was a delicate negotiation with a lot of organizations as to how it was we could arrive to shoot there and still contribute in some way while fulfilling the needs of the film and giving a little momentum and help and aid around the very final completion of the restoration in order to allow and to motivate the organizations around it to allow the place to be open to the public, which is what it should be and is about to be very, very soon.
What was it like to be there and to work there?
Incredible, really. There was about a 5-day period when the house was, as we believe, Eileen Gray built it and completed it in 1926. So we were allowed incredible access and permission to not just restore or you know, we had a, I suppose what we did in the end was we agreed with all the authorities what we called a kind of a snag list. So that was kind of quite a thing to have a snag list for Eileen Gray's house. And that was a thing that was negotiated with many architects and our own production design crew over months and months. And the snag list consisted of various things. There were the things that needed to be done so that that work that needed to be done on the house now, work that needed to be done on the house to agreed that were changes that needed to be made, that were things that they had restored that people didn't agree with. So there were those changes. And then there were the things that we wanted to do for the film that would then be taken away. So we arrived at a place, and it was kind of incredible because we'd been shooting in studio in Belgium, and then the whole crew, because it was an Irish-Belgian crew, drove all the way through France, through Vézelay, where Eileen Gray also did a lot of work, down to E1027 and arrived to find that the art department had finished the house. It was incredible. Well, almost. And over the weekend finished the house. And the first day of shooting, for the first 5 days, it was a house exactly as we thought, and with every piece of furniture, the wall colours, it was like a magic place. It was incredible.
And when can we expect to see the film?
Oh, well, we're still working on it here in Dublin until at least March. So soon, early mid next year, we hope.
Terrific. Yeah. Mary McGuckin, thanks so much.
Delighted. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Arts Tonight. We're visiting the Eileen Gray exhibition at IMA in Dublin. Join us in a moment to consider Gray's achievement and legacy. This is Vincent Woods with Arts Tonight. Eileen Gray, architect, designer, painter, is currently running at the Irish Museum of Modern Art at Kilmainham in Dublin. And joining me now in studio to discuss Gray's work and legacy, Aidan Dunn, art critic with the Irish Times, Yvonne Farrell of Grafton Architects, who took part in a recent symposium on City as Archive, a house for Eileen Gray as part of the Gray programme at IMA, and artist Sasha Sykes, who also took part in that event, and some of whose work as a designer and furniture maker seem to reflect a line of influence from Eileen Gray. Aidan Dunn, this show at IMA highlights just how diverse and impressive Eileen Gray's work is.
It does indeed. It's a superb exhibition, and it's very revealing because we never really realised how important or how versatile Eileen Gray was. Chloe Bidio, the curator from the Pompidou, put it very well when she said that her reputation rests really on only a fraction of what she actually accomplished. And Chloe sees her as moving from being a kind of an art deco, decorative arts person, which she did begin as in say, when she moved to Paris in 1907. She began as a kind of making decorative art objects. But very quickly, she assimilated modernist ideas and had an extraordinarily good grasp. Sometimes Irish people are really good at this, like you can say the way Louis Le Broquet could see what Cubism was about later in Ireland. She very quickly got a grasp of the central importance of what was happening in architecture, and she became an architect without any formal training as such. I mean, she was closely involved with a Romanian qualified architect, Jean Baldovici, who was very important to her. But it's like she just managed to absorb all these ideas and all these things. And also, it should be said about her that she was a person who didn't... she wasn't, say, a conceptual artist in the sense that she didn't just have ideas. She really believed in doing things properly and in seeing things. You can see that in, for example, a lot of the furniture that's on show in IMA. I mean, overwhelmingly, they are prototypes. And you can see the careful thinking and making and the difference using different materials, seeing how this material goes, that material goes, being acutely aware of the quality of the materials and how they would perform and how they would appear, and also their other associations. She did all that to an extraordinary degree with an incredible sensitivity and with great skill and great instinct.
And I suppose, again, one of the striking aspects of the show at IMA is how all of these strands are so interlinked. You see a single mind at work in shaping everything. And in drawing all of them together, I think we really see that. Again, people have talked about a genius in Eileen Gray and her work. And I think, in a way, this show really helps to illuminate that.
It does help to illuminate that. And it does show, as Chloe put it, a global artistic personality who was able to work in every single area with the same level of conviction, so that you say, yes, she was an architect. She also painted consistently. She took photographs. And in everything she did, the aesthetic quality comes through, in that she didn't think, oh, this is craft and this is art, or this is business and this is pleasure. Her whole life seems to be dedicated to making things with the same rigor and sensibility that she brought to big projects, she brought to tiny things as well.
And I suppose, again, her work seems to almost anticipate the modern, but there's no doubt that she was also an essential part of the shaping of the modern, and maybe doesn't always get enough credit for that.
Well, notoriously at this stage, yes, she's been kind of eclipsed, and her role in, and she did have a very formative, creative part in shaping the modernist movement. But for various reasons, her role was eclipsed over time. One of those reasons was their peculiar relationship with Le Corbusier, the French architect, and that there is unfortunately strong evidence that he deliberately sort of wrote or helped to write her out of the history of the time, because he became such a dominant, important figure and held such sway over the whole scholarship of the period, and that his influence actually worked against Eileen Gray's reputation being recognised.
Yvonne Farrell, your recent talk on Gray's work was called Built Skin, and this references, I suppose, aspects of her work as an architect and designer. Could you elaborate a little bit on that idea of Gray shaping spaces for life and living, building these new skins, as both, I suppose, to hold her made ideas and also to free them?
The term Built Skin was something that I tried to convey the idea that she began with herself or the human being central, and that she really thought about dimension and texture and touch, and that moved out from the seat, from the table, to the space, to the light, how she controlled light, and then that marvellous drawing, which was really a wonderful episode in my life when I saw a plan drawing with the effect of the sun on the spaces. So she really thought about what she did in, if you like, in global terms, I mean in terms of the earth. So it went from the precise touch to the space.
So when you look at, for instance, any of the houses she designed, you're looking at the totality of it. It's not just the building, it's everything within the building. And it's, in a sense, everything is one.
It's, you can imagine from the drawings and from the models and from the if you like, descriptions of the building, that she's on a seat, she walks up a step, she's on a terrace, she's viewing out, she uses shutters to control control light, to protect against the wind. That what is amazing, and what I find, I suppose, the Built Skin reference is really saying that she moves out from the human being so specifically. She's not as interesting when Aidan was talking about Le Corbusier in terms of the influence of, say, architectural training. It seems to me that that's a much more intellectual and object-driven into which a human being goes. And there's a very interesting thing where Le Corbusier is trying to get her to change one of the entrances because he thinks it should be quicker. And she describes it beautifully. She talks about, you know, that you arrive in just to quote her, that she doesn't want to do this, and she says to enter into a house, the desire to penetrate, a transition that's still a mystery, a kind of a thing in suspense. And she described it, the pleasure of arriving is like a boat into a harbour, a feeling of being enclosed and but free to circulate. And there's a kind of a sensual aspect to her work, which I think is really, it comes from her ability to make at the most intimate level and then to move out so spatially. I think she's sensual at the level of light, so light is sensual as well. It's not just a thing that you let in through apertures.
I'm glad you quoted those words, because she wrote very well, and time and again through the exhibition you're struck by something she said. I mean, the idea as well that before you make a piece of art you should question everything, or this, you know, the idea that beautiful work speaks more truth than the artist. I mean, mm-hmm. she was a philosopher as well, and she was a thinker as well as a maker. I suppose that's what made her a great maker as well. But you, I think, have an Eileen Gray table, and in your talk you described the perfect simplicity of that piece.
Well, it's the only piece I own. It's probably not even a proper copy, but what is amazing is that when you look at it, and also for the talk, I really looked at it in detail, and I realised that it has 8 choices of heights. It, at 45 millimetre apart, there's a tiny metal bar, and the chain can go in to adjust it. So it goes from 540 millimetres to as high as 860. And I was kind of writing out all these dimensions because I was trying to imagine how Eileen Gray was. She must have thought about these precise dimensions at one stage. So you've got, I mean, what table do you know that has 8 choices? What table do you know that has a handle? And as I said, it's a bit like kind of Goldilocks. It's not too heavy. It's not too light. It's just right. And also that it's 2 circles held apart. One is complete and one is open. So this is an abstraction, if you like, 2 circles held apart. But the broken circle on the base has a functional use. It's a wonderful way you can push it in under a couch, you can put it in under a bed. That what I find amazing about her is that you have this piece, it's beautiful to look at. The glass means you can put hot things on it and you're not worried about timber being damaged or whatever, so you can have boiling things. And she takes just metal and glass. I think it's interesting, there's one in the exhibition which is Sycamore, I think, and it's black, but I've got used to the chrome and the glass. But it really epitomises her ability to have this thing, you could just look at it and it's beautiful. And the reflection on the, like even the what I find amazing is that even the diameters of the metal change. So the handle is the exact one for your hand. The dimension, the length of it, the enclosures for the holding of the glass. And recently there was just one of the pieces I don't know very well is her the mirror in E1027. And one of our students did an amazing drawing recently.
South of France,
yeah. Yes. And when he did the drawing for us, I was amazed at the versatility. I'd kind of looked at it as a thing in space, but how it functions. And he actually did an interesting take on it because he'd started doing an Escher drawing in the mirror. So even a young person in their early 20s looking at her work now can translate it into a kind of an Escher expression.
When you're describing the table there, it strikes me again that, and I suppose maybe any good maker of things has to be, in a sense, has to be an engineer as well. And yes. And that strong element in what she's doing. And you also emphasised her belief in craft, in the craft of making. And I suppose, again, that absolutely essential, that dedication to craft in everything that she did.
Well, what I loved reading, I mean, you could imagine a woman coming from her kind of background, painting, having a kind of an easy life. But what she did when she went to Paris, she asked the guys, could she learn how to learn the lacquer technique? She wasn't a dilettante. What I find amazing about her is that she worked really, I mean, Aidan referred to her earlier on, she works really hard all the time. I can imagine her being absolutely fastidious about each millimetre. In fact, I read recently where she was talking to somebody many, many years later who asked, could he make a reproduction? And she said, yeah, but could you modify it? Just there was kind of a millimetre that she wanted to adjust. And I loved that she was remembering the effect of that millimetre on a human being, and she wanted to adjust it. Yes, craft, I think that's what's central to her, that she, I think she must have talked very well with the craftsmen that she made the houses with. And it's interesting watching the 3 houses which she was specifically involved in, that it's more and more modest, if you like, the older she got, the farmhouse, the kind of final farmhouse with the addition. But I think craft and making were central. She realised it wasn't just idea, that it was actually the final touch, how you ran your hand across a handle, how you sat. So I think, yes, craft was central. The making was central to her specific ideas.
In terms of the hard work, I remember Bruce Chatwin, who was a friend of hers, writing about when he knew her in Paris and she was in her late 70s, and that she thought nothing of working 14 hours a day. I believe that her screens have influenced some of the designs that you've made, that Grafton Architects have made. So yes, for buildings.
Yes, I think what we find about her wonderful screens is the ability to describe space in surface and void. And there were 3 buildings that, if you like, specifically we refer to her. And one is the side elevation in our project for Bocconi University in Milan, where we have a very solid elevation along a side street in that city, where the solid and void is really, if you like, inspired by her. And also the elevation from the Department of Finance looking out onto the Huguenot Cemetery. We wanted, the Huguenot Trust allowed us to make windows out to this sacred place, if you like, but we wanted to make a deep wall, and we were inspired inspired, if you like, by the ability of her screen to give that solid and void. And then finally, recently, we've just finished a project in Limerick University where we have a colonnade in limestone. So that whole issue of her ability to make these beautiful things still is inspirational. But going back to what you were saying there about work, one of the things I love is that in 1942, when she's in Castellar, she writes, "I'm terribly cut off from work." And then she describes that as the only thing worthwhile to keep alive. I mean, that's incredible, that this incredible anchor of her life is the expression through form she makes.
Sasha Sykes, as a maker, a modern maker of furniture, of art pieces, as was sometimes inspired by landscape, but often as well with a wonderful urban edge. You know, some people have said that they see perhaps an accidental line of connection to Eileen Gray in your work. Has she been significant for you?
Yeah, absolutely. She's really inspired me as a person. She's really inspired me in her approach, and you know, who she was, where she was, what she was doing. She's really inspired me. And then I directly reinterpreted one of her pieces for the National Museum a few years back, one of the brick screens. And I think a lot of my materials I work with are quite similar. I think she was really, really into materials, and that sensibility went right through to materials. And that comes across, I think, comes through to my work. I don't know if it's conscious or subconscious, but I find her, yeah, an incredibly inspiring person.
Returning to that again, I suppose that if you think of Eileen Gray as an international artist, you're living as well in this international world, you know, London, New York, Carlo as a base. How essential is that to have an international profile that both celebrates what you can do here in Ireland, but also obviously expands the possibilities both for sale and for real recognition?
It definitely helps at home when you've been abroad. There's something about that thing if you come back from New York and everyone celebrates you.
Doors open for you.
Doors open, even though you might not have done that much while you're away. It's great to have the inspiration and obviously the contacts you get from working abroad and being based in the middle of Carlow and, you know, very rural setup, and being able to go to the cities, to these, you know, really vibrant cities for inspiration. And it's, you know, it's brilliant. And I think as a designer, you need to keep connected with what people want and what people need for their lives and living every day. And you just need to be connected to people. It's all about people, really, at the end of the day.
The Eileen Gray exhibition at IMA, when you saw that, what did you make of that, the fullness of her career and work?
Oh, it's incredible, isn't it? She just achieved so much in, you know, such a variety of work, and it's incredible to see the progress through the decades of what she did and what she achieved, and to see it all in some level of context is wonderful.
Aidan Dunn, we looked at the reopened IMA on last week's programme, a very impressive programme of exhibitions and events, the Eileen Gray included, and it's good to see the main building there and the gallery spaces back in business.
It's very reassuring, I think, to see that they're back in Cluniac and that things are up and running. And also to begin so well, I think, is important, yeah. There were significant delays in getting back in, but that's always the way with these projects that involve very complex architectural. They have to get planning permission to put in a lift and so on. In the longer term, I mean, as Sarah Glenny, the director, I think, has acknowledged, they do face some serious problems in terms of funding, like any other public institution. I think the public cultural institutions have suffered disproportionately in terms of falls in funding. And when you think that IMA basically is funded to the extent that they can open the doors, but not that you will see anything when you go in those doors, I think that that shows you the extent of the problem. And they're going to have to concentrate much more on cooperation, on fundraising initiatives, on getting commercial sponsorship, those sort of areas. And I think they are addressing those very, very urgently. We're not used to that so much, I think, in this country as say they are in America. We don't have a kind of philanthropic culture or tradition. Also, perhaps as our economy hopefully improves gradually, we will channel more money into the cultural area, which has been a kind of a true friend through the awful years of the Depression. I think everyone would agree. So hopefully we learn lessons in that respect.
Aidan Dunn, thank you very much indeed. And thanks also to Yvonne Farrell and Sasha Sykes for joining us in studio. Eileen Gray, architect, designer, painter, runs at IMA until January the 28th. Sarah Brown's work can be seen in the One Foot in the Real World show at IMA, and in that show Still We Work at the 126 Gallery in Galway until November the 24th. And to see Sasha Sykes' work, go to farm21.co.uk. Next week, Walking the Wild Side, a special programme to remember another singular genius, the late Lou Reed. Do join us then, Monday night at 10. Till then, goodbye.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, was produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.